I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Stephen Kotler. He's a journalist and author. His new book is Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this book runs the gamut from inspiring to interesting to frightening to downright crazy, in my personal opinion. And it's all about really what human beings can invent with enough time and enough tools. This is something you've been looking at and writing about for quite a long time.
Yeah, the core question that I was looking at in the heart of the book is about the transformation of science fiction into science fact, right, and the massively disruptive impact that transformation has on culture. And yeah, it was something in the 90s. I got to know Peter Diamandis. He was working on the X-Prize, which was the private race into space. And I had just come off of doing a bunch of different sort of rocket science-related stories, and it struck me that Peter, while the whole world thought he was crazy and thought we would never build private spaceships, knowing what I had done from previous reporting, I went, oh, this seems possible. I wonder what else is possible. So I made a long list of all the kind of science fiction technologies from the 20th century, and I started paying attention to them. And what was so startling is in the past 25 years, most of those technologies have turned into science fact.
We want to talk about a bunch of them. There's too many to cover on this show in any depth, but I guess I'm interested in talking about the things I'd never heard of, never heard anything about at all. One of them was artificial vision implants, and we're not talking about the eye, but the brain itself.
Yeah, this was a startling experience. This started out as a piece for Wired magazine, and I spent about a year investigating the frontiers of artificial vision research, right? And people were working all kinds of cool stuff at USC, at the University of Utah, but we were nowhere near artificial vision. And then right as I was about to start writing the story, my editor at Wired got a postcard in the mail that said, "Hi, I'm William DeBell. I've invented the world's first artificial vision implant. We're about to turn it on. Come check it out." And we looked at each other like, well, who is this guy? This is crazy. This can't be real. And William DeBell, when we looked into him, it turned out he was a maverick inventor and a vision inventor from the 60s and 70s that nobody had really heard from in almost 20 years.
Vision inventor?
Yeah, he had worked on... They figured out a long time ago that if you can take a camera and import what a camera captures into the brain, right, into the occipital lobe that processes vision, your brain is really good at taking whatever signals we give it and turning it into information. So using this kind of system, they figured, hey, we probably are going to be able to create artificial vision implants. It's the same thing we did with cochlear implants and hearing, right? It was, you got a good enough detector and the brain can unscramble the signals pretty easily. So they were going to do this with vision. Nobody had done it. Nobody had even thought about doing it. The surgery itself was illegal in America. So turns out this guy had performed the surgery in Portugal, and, you know, of course I had to go check it out, and it was the craziest thing in the world, because here was this thing that was totally, completely impossible. Day one, I show up. I meet a blind man. He's been blind in both eyes for 21 years. And 3 days later, after this thing has been turned on, he can see well enough to drive a car around a crowded parking lot. It was astounding.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's so amazing about that is that the signals that come through a camera can be understood with the receptors that go into your brain. In other words, what the eye sees and what the camera sees are similar enough that,
well,
the brain can decode it?
The best way to think about this, and this is Baylor neuroscientist David Eagleman, he just kind of gave a TED talk about this idea, but it turns out our brain, if you think of our brain as a computer, it's a processing unit, it handles kind of whatever peripheral you want to attach it to. Our eyes are one kind, our ears are another, right? Sense of touch, these are all just peripheral systems. It turns out that if you can plug any information source into the brain and you can deal with biocontamination, things like that, you know, where it comes in, we can essentially interpret any information and turn it differently. It's why one of the things they do for blind people now is they send signals in through a haptic device that pinches the tongue, and it turns vision into literally like movement on the tongue, and we can turn this into a map of the field, and it's not quite sight, but it, you know, it allows blind people to navigate.
Is this now being used by very many people?
So the interesting thing about DeBell is he was very, very sick when he was performing this operation, and he died very shortly afterwards. The operation was performed on 3 people, and the technology sort of went to his grave with him. Nobody's kind of revisited. They've done a lot of other stuff. They're working on all kinds of crazy stuff. A couple weeks ago, somebody actually figured out how to grow an eye and I'm not sure if it's the whole eye or just the retina, from stem cells. So there's a lot of work on this field, and what DeBell really did is he was proof of concept. He was the guy who said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't crazy, we can actually do this.
Another amazing invention is bionic limbs. Tell us about the mountain climber, Hugh Herr.
So Hugh Herr is the inventor of the world's first bionic ankle, and his story is astounding. When he was a kid growing up, they called him the Wonder Boy. He was one of the youngest ever kind of mountaineers to summit a bunch of the 14ers in America. He was a great rock climber. He was fantastic. And when he was 19 years old, I believe, maybe 17 years old, he lost both of his legs below the knee in a mountaineering accident, and he got prosthetic limbs. And very quickly, he was such a climbing geek, and he wanted to climb again. He went into the machine shop and started customized climbing limbs for himself. So instead of having a prosthetic leg, a stump, he had like beveled legs to fit into cracks and things like this. It led him to a crazy conclusion, which is, hey, wait a minute, I'm not disabled, technology is disabled. So he dedicated his life basically to kind of improving technology, and it's led us to the first bionic ankle. I got a chance to hang out with Dr. Major David Rozelle, who's the recipient of the first bionic ankle. He's the world's first bionic soldier. Crazy story. We met in Boulder, Colorado, and it was a cold, rainy, windy day in the winter, and there was still snow on the ground, and we were walking around Boulder, and he's got his bionic leg, and we come to a busy four-lane street. Traffic is flowing both ways, moving really, really quickly, and me, the able-bodied guy, we're lost in conversation, stops at the edge of the traffic. The guy with the bionic limb kind of looks at the traffic, darts across the first lane, freezes, jumps across the second line, freezes, jumps across the third lane, leaps over a puddle, leaps over a snowbank, and sort of pirouettes onto the other side on a bionic limb. It was like the full-on Walter Payton, which is to say these things really, really work. And that was where we were a couple years ago. Where we are now is 50% of the human body is now replaceable by bionics, right? We have machine-brain interfaces that let us communicate with these real-life bionic limbs for quadriplegics or paraplegics simply by thinking about it. Where it gets really interesting and crazy, because everything we've been talking about so far is replacement parts. And these are amazing, but next year, 2016, we're going to start seeing the first exoskeletons. This is strap-on bionics, right? This means you've got a bum knee, and you can now put on a brace, and it's a bionic knee brace, basically. And by bionic, what I mean is it doesn't just direct your knee's motion kind of in the perfect place. It puts energy back into the system. So if you think about our aging population, right, the number one complaint the aged is they lose control of their bodies, right, and their energy goes down. We've now got technology coming on the market this year that is going to put energy back into the system. It's literally like fountain of youth type of technology, which if you kind of go out one step, well, one of the reasons our retirement age is at 65 is because our bodies wind down, right? That is up with the largest group of boomers ever, retirees ever is about to hit that market, and we're about to be able to prolong their careers. The retirement age is going to, bionics will absolutely change the retirement age within 5 years.
Will that technology be available to ordinary people? Will insurance pay for it and things like that?
If the bionic ankle is anything to go by, what they discovered with soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, the amputees, which drove a lot of this research, right, kind of the tragedy going on, it is cheaper to give them a bionic limb than it is to do something else because of all of the other things that happen to bodies as they get wear down. Morbid obesity, lack of ability to go to work, etc., etc. There's a huge healthcare savings cost in this, so Medicare wants to pay for these things. So as of right now, yeah, they're accessible to everybody because they're saving insurance companies money down the line.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his new book, Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. What are the cultural implications of bionics? I mean, one of the things that it made me think of was, will it foster a culture of carelessness? I mean, when you think about these mountain climbers, I read in your book what they did, and they went up to almost the top of a mountain, and it was really cold and windy and snowing, and they said, hey, let's just go to the top of the mountain, which, I mean, for me as a reader, how stupid can you be? They put themselves in harm's way. Another climber on search and rescue got killed looking for them. And yeah, that's sort of 17-year-old boy stuff, but if everybody thinks, oh, well, I don't need this leg, I can always get another one, what does that mean for us as a society?
I think replacement parts, along with a number of other kind of technologies I talk about in the book, opens up that can of worms. For certain, it is going to make, you know, adventure sports more dangerous. The risk level's already through the roof, and it's going to keep going through the roof because we're going to, you know, our bodies are going to be capable of doing more because of this technology. And yeah, at some point, we're going to be able to get replacement parts fairly easily. That's going to be a radical shift for sure. The thing that's interesting to me is the deeper psychological level right underneath that, which is, you know, for as long as we've been on this planet, growing old is what happened to an organism, right? Life, the body slowed down. The brain, the evolution of the brain is sort of shaped to expect this decline. And I think, you know, we think we're building new bodies with bionics, but my guess is we're going to end up with radically new minds. I think that we're going to have deep fundamental psychological changes that are brought on by kind of this enhanced vitality.
And those changes will be available to some people and not others. There are huge class and national implications to this when that kind of technology is only partially available.
Well, it's an interesting question. Let me put it a different way, though. So bionics, which you think is this technology that's totally out of reach, and you're essentially arguing that it's only going to be for the wealthy.
Or wealthy countries.
Well, wealthy or wealthy countries. What I'm trying to say is that a couple weeks ago, you can get online and find 3D printing blueprints to 3D print yourself on a couple $100 3D printer a bionic arm. So already this, I mean, it's scaled down. It's not the iWalk. It's not what UHair is making at MIT, right? It's a very scaled down version, but people are using 3D printers. It started with dads. Parents of children who were disabled, they didn't like the prosthetics that were offered to their children. They said, wow, 3D printing, it's really cheap now. Anybody can afford one of these things. We can do all kinds of cool stuff. Can we use it to make bionic replacement parts? And the answer is yes. And the answer is, you know, soon 3D printers are showing up. They're already starting to show up in places like Staples. So you can find your blueprints and then go to Staples and use their printers to print whatever you want. So on a certain level, you are right. There's going to be certain technology that is reserved for the wealthy and for the wealthy countries. That's absolutely going to happen. But one of the things that's happening is a lot of this technology is getting so dirt cheap. We've seen this in synthetic biology. Even with something very controversial about genetically engineered crops, the big argument against Monsanto was, hell, they're patenting these genes. What are they doing? The counter argument is these technologies are dirt cheap, and any country in the world can afford them and can use them in the same way Monsanto is using them. So, yes, you are correct. There are going to be certain things that slot into this category, but they don't seem to stay there for long right now.
One thing, moving on from bionics, that I also found really interesting, I mean, is an aspect of science fiction brought from the concept of reshaping Mars for human habitation to reshaping this very Earth back to its natural ecosystems. It's called terraforming. In your chapter on terraforming, you're writing about a massive Earth-moving project to restore the Everglades, at least within the boundaries of politics and communities and society, which, I mean, if you were really going to restore it, it would look a little different. But there's communities and cities and sugarcane growing people. But what is going on there, and what is the kind of sci-fi aspect to it?
Well, the sci-fi aspect is, for a really long time, we've talked about terraforming Mars mostly. The idea being we could go to another planet, and we can re-engineer atmospheres and ecosystems and whatnot. And historically, we've been terrible at this, right? We tried it in Biosphere 2. It was an abject failure, right? That was that dome in the Arizona desert. It did not work. But along the way, because the Everglades became such a colossal disaster, environmental disaster, the Everglades Restoration Project was born and signed into law by Clinton, and it's the largest public works project undertaken. And what they're literally trying to do is rebuild the ecosystem. They've got to change everything. As you've mentioned, the geography's changed radically, but they're trying to rebuild the functionality of an ecosystem. And the truth of the matter is, what they're doing in Florida matters, both in Florida, it also matters globally. This is the first time we've ever tried to do this. We have a lot of ecosystems that are in trouble, and how goes Florida, so goes the rest of the world. It's also crazy because we hear about all these mega engineering projects right now, right? How do you fight global warming? And there's all kinds of like, do we want to try this at scale? Don't we want to try this at scale? We've already started. We're actually already doing one of these giant mega engineering projects in Florida, and it's been going on for 20 years. That's kind of the astounding part here.
What does it actually look like? Like, what are they doing?
It's a blend of a lot of really high-tech and a lot of low-tech technologies. Wetlands normally kind of filter pollution out of water supply, and because of all the sugarcane, phosphorus levels are massively high, and they're killing everything in the system. That's one of the problems they're trying to fight. So they've created this giant, giant kind of wetlands water processing plant that is trying to lower phosphorus numbers to the lowest numbers on Earth. It's a very high-tech project done in a low-tech way, right? I mean, they're just using plants that absorb phosphorus along the way in different bends, but how they're working the water through the maize is it's a new way of cleaning it up. They're also trying to capture billions of gallons of water that show up during the wet season, drive it underground, and then re-release it during the dry season to mimic sheet flow, which is the whole top of the Everglades moves as a single unit. It flows as giant sheets. Everything in the system depends on that sheet flow. That's what one of the things that's been totally destroyed. That's one of the things we're trying to mimic and bring back by putting water back into the system in the dry system. It goes kind of on and on and on, and it's massively complicated and only made possible by kind of the computer revolution, right? We can gather data at a really, really minute level and actually see if we can do this.
I think the thing that's appealing about this particular one to me is that, I mean, ecosystems, and you write about this, are much more complex than human beings can understand. We're always working in the dark. We're always discovering not only new processes, but new species and what their role is in an ecosystem. And so when you talk about restoration, ultimately the idea is to have the system reach a state of equilibrium where it takes care of itself.
For sure. And it's funny because there's a lot of technologies that I talk about in Tomorrowland that are a lot more kind of futuristic and far out there. But terraforming, because of the complexity of ecosystems, just seems to me like I look at this. I mean, and the project's still moving on. It's got stumbling blocks of problems. They're going forward. They're coming back. It's been going on for a very, very long time. But it is such a huge undertaking. I mean, I think what we're going to end up learning when it's done, I don't think there's no way it's going to be successful. Not probably not in my lifetime. I would be very surprised, first of all. Second of all, I think what we're going to learn once again is how much we don't know.
Another thing, speaking of how much we don't know, which to me is downright scary, is the engineering of life itself. Now, why, for example, would anyone want to engineer a mosquito?
It's a really interesting project. Insect-borne ailments are, you know, massively devastating. They're becoming far more common, right? Global warming, we know these things are much more problematic, and they're much more problematic here in America, right? We've got dengue fever back, malaria is coming back. A lot of things that haven't been here for 100 years are coming back, and some of them are more virulent strains or strains we've never seen before. One way to fight back is that we have created the world's first genetically engineered organism. It is a mosquito that is engineered to not be able to breed malaria. So you introduce this mosquito into wild populations, it outcompetes normal mosquitoes, it performs the same ecological function, except it cannot transmit malaria. So it's one of the most advanced cures for disease ever created. And yes, absolutely, much like our terraforming conversation, the biggest issue is it's an amazing technology. But what are the unintended consequences of introducing, you know, genetically engineered organisms? I still have to, in spite of the gee whiz factor is astounding to me here. This is the first creature that was birthed entirely in our imagination that has taken up resonance in reality. And that's, to me, so the gee whiz factor is really high. The danger factor is equally high.
When you say the first organism, you're talking about organism in the animal kingdom. I mean, we have genetically engineered plants.
Yes.
So I look at this, I read this chapter, and I'm thinking, haven't we learned enough lessons about meddling with wildlife to know, or meddling with life to know that, I mean, okay, we create an insect Frankenstein, that doesn't carry malaria. Maybe it carries Ebola or HIV.
Unintended consequences are the big fear. And everybody talks about it, and they've already released these mosquitoes into the wild. So ultimately, there's pilot projects in, I believe, Brazil that have done this. So we're going to find out one way or the other. And the answer is, yeah, there's going to be unintended consequences. The question is, with GE crops, for example, right, if you can get past a lot of the hoopla, yes, there are unintended consequences. They're nowhere near as big as people think they are, and they don't show up along the lines that we're looking for. I often think, and I think one of the things that Tomorrowland kind of points out is, oftentimes the things that we're worried about are the things we can guard against, right? It's what we can't see that's going to come get us.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. There's another kind of meddling with life and mortality, namely life extension, a lot of which seems to be focused, at least in your chapter, on males and using anabolic steroids. And it turns out, of course, that there's a lot of politics mixed up with the science here. One thing that was new to me in this chapter and in this discussion of anabolic steroids was the use of steroids early on in the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Steroids was our first sort of real life extension technology. And the thing, if you look at the story of it, one of the things that's really interesting to me, and I think Tomorrowland kind of looks at across the board, is how hard it really is to invent the future, right? It's, the politics are astounding, the fights are astounding, and, history is always written by the victors, and the same thing is true with kind of scientific and technological history, so we don't see the massive amount of struggle and pushback you get from culture along the way. And steroids, here's a dual-use technology. It turns out, if you actually kind of read through the medical literature on steroids, the reason the life extension community is so hot on these drugs is because they perform astounding benefits. We don't know about that because they also unlevel the playing field in sports. So there's been a ton of propaganda along the way. One of the things they discovered that steroids are really, really good for is fighting back AIDS. Millions of people, arguably, have died from that disease, especially back in the 80s and 90s. We knew this information, but the politics of steroids kept it out of the public. We took Walter Jacot, who was the doctor who kind of pioneered this approach to AIDS, and they put him in jail for 5 years, and he sort of became, they called him the world's first AIDS martyr, right? And he became, for the whole life extension community, he became this like poster child of, be really careful with this stuff, don't talk about it out loud, it's really scary out there, they mean it, they'll put you in jail.
But I mean, there were these young men who had AIDS, not just HIV, who took anabolic steroids and their muscle mass increased, that kind of wasting disease went away, they became healthy, and arguably they could have lived with that kind of treatment until AZT and
exactly.
The cocktail
exactly.
Were invented.
That's exactly what we missed out on. So if you talk to people, especially in the AIDS community, especially from back in the 80s and the 90s when this kind of war was being fought, they will tell you that the U.S. government cost us millions and millions of lives.
So what about anabolic steroids as a treatment? I mean, what we hear about them and what we read about them, and it's on the NIH site and the CDC site and any site that you choose to read, that there are real dangers associated with the use of these hormones.
So it's interesting. When you actually look under the hood, you find a ton of studies that show that most of those dangers are almost non-existent. Now, there's caveats. For children, for anybody growing up whose hormones are not, fully completely developed.
Including teenagers.
Teenagers, right. They're disastrous. So kids are right off, take them off the boards. Life extension, they're dealing with people in their 40s and their 50s is a different thing. But even then, interestingly, so Nick Evans is at UCLA. He's the only person who's ever done a long-term steroid study, right? Does this stuff really affect us over 10 years, over 20 years, over 30 years? And the weirdest thing about it is he went and talked to bodybuilders, which nobody had ever done. So Nick's big breakthrough was, wow, I should go talk to the people who are actually using these substances. And what he discovered is that over the long term, they almost have no harmful qualities, except if you're using massive, massive bodybuilding stacking doses, the heart is a muscle. Sooner or later, you're going to enlarge the heart. It's going to have pumping problems. So there are long-term effects if you're taking massive levels of these things. Now, there's kind of brand new science starting to come out on lower level kind of hormone replacement stuff, and it's showing a mixed bag, right? It's showing kind of some amazing leap forward in a mixed bag. What you're seeing in the life extension community right now is steroids, hormones are being treated as one out of six or seven different categories that people are playing with. But just to put it in context, to just give you a nice sense of how fast we're moving on all this stuff, every day that you're alive, you gain 5 hours of life expectancy. No exercise required, simply because these technologies are moving forward so quickly.
What about women? I mean, there was really no mention of how these things work for females. Obviously, we're not going to be taking levels of testosterone in any major quantity.
Hormone replacement therapy is what they've looked at in women. Testosterone declines in men as well as in women. And you can't, right? Estrogen is downstream from testosterone, so you need it in the system one way or the other. But no, the article was focused on specifically on what was going on in that population. And yeah, you're right, there aren't a lot of women there.
Let's shift gears entirely. There are some chapters in the book on what might be called spiritual experiences, from out-of-body experiences to psychedelic medicine. And you had an out-of-body experience once while jumping out of an airplane. These are fairly common. I mean, I know perfectly rational people who had them. A friend of mine had an out-of-body experience while in labor when she was in so much pain that she just basically checked out and watched herself giving birth. These things happen. What do we know about them now that we didn't know before? What's the science?
The science is really pretty astounding. And there's kind of been a revolution over the past 50 years, starting with the work of a guy named Wilder Penfield back in the 50s, all the way kind of through today. And what we've really done is we've kind of uncovered the neurobiology of so-called mystical experiences. So a giant range of seemingly really disparate experiences, cosmic unity, the feeling of becoming one with everything, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, trance states, meditative states, flow states. The list is kind of really goes on and on and on. We've really come to understand a lot how a lot of this stuff works. And it's getting a lot more peculiar than that. I'll give you a classic example of this. So back in the 50s, Wilder Penfield, who was a Canadian neurosurgeon, he was working on epilepsy, and they were probing for auras. He had opened up people's skulls, he was stimulating parts of their cortex, trying to trigger an aura, which is a perceptual disturbance that precedes...
An aura?
Aura is the technical term for it. To change in a perceptual disturbance that comes right before an epileptic seizure. So some people see certain colors or hear smells or hear sounds. They call that an aura. And the idea was he could find the spot that triggers the aura, and then he could cut it out of the brain. That it was a radical treatment for epilepsy. But he first had to probe the brain with these electrodes. And when he started touching people's right temporal lobe, all kinds of really strange stuff started happening. People would have out-of-body experiences. They'd have near-death experiences. Kind of went on and on and on. In fact, they also felt like a sense presence, like a god or an angel in the room. So flash forward to where we are now. There's a guy named Michael Persinger. He's at Laurentian University in Canada. He has created, it's called the God Helmet. It is a helmet that directs weak electromagnetic fields at the right temporal lobe. Over 1,000 people have worn it, and 80% of the people who have worn it, some people have out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, experience cosmic unity, 80% feel a sense presence, the feeling of a god, a ghost, a demon, or some other in the room with them. What's really crazy about this is, right, so if we've taken an experience that was, you know, a spiritual experience, we've explained the biology, we've built technology to kind of hack that biology, the next step is... it's becoming scalable. Anybody can have this experience. There's a God helmet, there's a version of the God helmet that is for sale online. I think it's called the Shakti helmet. Persinger himself has talked about, hey, can we incorporate this into new virtual reality devices, sort of like the Oculus Rift devices? So pretty soon, kind of the experience of the numinous might be available in a video game, which is, if you stop and think that, you know, currently today, 80 million Americans are quote-unquote spiritual but not religious, right? Which means, says, hey, look, I've rejected the hand-me-downs, and what I want is direct experiential proof in my own life. I want these experiences, this taste. We've not got a technology that can give you a taste of that.
One thing that's, I think, still a mystery is the fact that when people have these out-of-body experiences, they can, quote-unquote, see things in some kind of way that seems to go beyond the senses. I mean, they have recollections of things that happened when their eyes were closed or when they were brain dead. They can read stuff that's on the other side of the room, that kind of thing.
Yeah, your near-death experiences, not out-of-body experiences. There are, for sure, right? Saying that we have decoded the neurobiology of spirituality, we have gotten at a lot of the mechanism, right? We understand kind of how this stuff works, which is not to say there are no mysteries left. And one of them is in the near-death experience studies, they've done tons of studies in hospitals. Is a really common one where they'll look at patients. You know, some patients die on the table and have near-death experiences, and they come back. Other people get right up next to the experiences, but they don't die. But all the other conditions, what drugs they're on, what illnesses they have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are stabilized. They're the same. And, you know, people with out-of-body experiences report all kinds of strange stuff. Like for this one you were talking about, this was done by Pim van Lommel in the Netherlands. At a patient, they took his glasses off, right? He was dead on the table. They took his glasses off. They put them in a drawer in a cabinet in the operating room. He was dead. They brought him back. They revived him. I think he was dead for 40 minutes, and they brought him back. 5 days later, they're looking around trying to find his glasses, and nobody can find them. And he says, oh, when I was out, the nurse took them off my face and she put them in the bottom drawer over there, and sure enough, they find it. What the heck that is, we have no idea.
Yeah.
There's still mystery left. We don't know what that is.
I love that there's still mystery left with that kind of thing, because we Western types who believe in science, and I'm one of them, although it's not the only thing that I believe in, but we think we know it all, and we don't.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, anytime you get anywhere near this stuff, right, we don't even, I mean, atheists love to talk about kind of the neurobiology of spiritual experience as proof that there's no God, right? This is the big, hey, look, we can explain this mechanistically, so there's obviously no God. That's actually a pretty big leap. I'm not saying that a God exists or doesn't exist, but all it tells us is these experiences are mediated biologically like every other experience we have on Earth. What it tells us is these experiences are kind of normal, right? We're hardwired for mystical experience. It doesn't answer any of the bigger why questions, and for sure across the boards in all these states, even in flow states, right, there a lot of people report having access to information that they shouldn't have access to. I tend to believe that this is just a problem for our measurement technology, and we're going to figure that one out. But a lot of other people want to believe that there's still a mystery out there, and you know, right now it's a puzzle, so I'm happy to give it to them.
And one of the things that does seem to come from these out-of-body and near-death experiences is a sense of well-being and a reduction of people's fear and fear of death.
Yeah, well, this is almost like the funny thing, which is, I mean, people have been telling us for thousands of years, right? Spiritual experiences are good for you, but we don't tend to believe them. But what we found out over the past kind of 50 years in study after study is these experiences, especially these profound mystical experiences, are really good for you. And the coolest example is work that was done by Willoughby Britton at the University of Arizona. And she said, hey, wait a minute. Near-death experiences, whatever else they are, they're a very strange response to trauma, right? Normal people, they almost die. They tend to have PTSD. But this category of people, they seem to be very, very happy. When you give them kind of psychological profiles and life, they score off the charts for life satisfaction, overall well-being. She went, I want to see if this is real. So she did an EEG sleep study. It turns out by looking at what time somebody goes into REM sleep, right, dreaming, you can predict basically their mood over the next year. Depressed people go into REM really early, 60 minutes, 70 minutes, right? Most normal people go in between kind of 80 and 90 minutes, right? Very happy people go in at about 100 minutes. And you can look at this. If somebody is going into REM sleep and they're at 60 minutes and they're not depressed, there's like a 99% chance they're going to get depressed over the next year. It's really predictive. It's really, the science is really solid. So when she did this with people who had near-death experiences, they were going into REM sleep at 110 minutes. It's off the charts for life satisfaction. So what this tells us is that these so-called transformative, transcendental, whatever experiences, they're not just psychologically transformative, they're actually neurobiologically transformative. They rewrite the brain.
There's another field, which is perhaps related to what we're talking about in some ways, which is the field of psychedelic medicine, which seems to be coming back now after the backlash against the 1960s counterculture and the war on drugs that resulted from that, and the horror and stupidity and politics of the war on drugs. And now there seems to be, I mean, certainly marijuana and medical marijuana are being legalized, but there's more openness politically and societally to studying the potential benefits of, I mean, you know, drugs like LSD and ecstasy. What kind of research is going on and what is it telling us?
The first thing to know is we are in the midst of an absolute psychedelic renaissance, right? And it's global. So, I mean, in Israel, Jordan, and Canada, they're all looking at MDMA to treat PTSD is one of the big cases.
MDMA being what's called ecstasy.
Or Molly, depending on, you know, which term you want. But yeah, MDMA is being used very effectively to treat PTSD, and they're using it for both soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. We had a study down in South Carolina that looked at that. We've also seen it being used to treat kind of child abuse issues and sexual violence, those sort of things. We're looking at LSD as a treatment for anxiety produced by life-threatening illness, mushrooms, psilocybin, same thing for that. In Mexico and Canada, we're doing experiments with ibogaine, which is an extremely powerful hallucinogenic, to treat opiate addiction. In Russia, they're looking at ketamine, which is another kind of disassociative, as a treatment for heroin addiction. We've kind of gone on and on. LSD is being used as a treatment for cluster headaches. The real point here is that most of these diseases, mushrooms for OCD, they're all very intractable. We're lousy at kind of curing people with PTSD, OCD, life-threatening anxiety, addiction. We're bad at these things. And what we're seeing over and over is that psychedelic compounds are extremely effective at treating these ailments.
Do people have to keep taking them, or is it a one-shot thing?
No, for the most part, it's a one-shot thing. You know, it's funny when they, for example, we talked a bit about the MDMA study in South Carolina, where they were looking at it for post-traumatic stress disorder, and they designed a protocol that had two therapy sessions. It's with a therapist. You take the drug. Usually have a male and a female therapist there at the same time. It's very protocoled out. But there were two drug sessions, and they were finding often that they only needed one. And, you know, interestingly, and we've seen this was a study done kind of in the 60s that was recently repeated at Johns Hopkins, even people facing kind of life-threatening anxiety, they're treated with one dose of LSD, and it's not like they feel better, you know, not only feel better immediately when they test them a month out, 2 months out, 6 months out, it lasts. So, yeah, they are seeing kind of single-dose applications.
Another piece of science in your book, and we're talking about the book Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact, and this is really getting toward science fiction when we talk about, as you did a moment ago, generating a retina from stem cells. Let's talk for a moment about stem cells. It's been ridiculously politicized. Let's leave aside the politics. What are some of the actual scientific medical benefits of stem cell medicine or potential becoming real?
Stem cells kind of goes across the boards, right? I mean, the biggest promise, the cutting edge is using stem cells for life extension, right? Replacement parts, we're getting better and better at kind of regrowing body parts. There's all kinds of different procedures now where you can inject stem cells into wounds to speed healing and that sort of stuff. So the technology is really kind of living into its own that way. It's still controversial. The same controversies that we had back kind of in the 90s when this technology was first discovered are still with us today, right? They have not gone away. These things are still extremely political, almost as political as steroids. And that's kind of one of the things I am looking at in Tomorrowland specifically is the political fight and kind of the disinformation campaign to get stem cells approved. The potential benefits from stem cells, I mean, everything you could possibly imagine. These allow us to regrow any part of the body from scratch, right? So if you can, it means, you know, you can regrow eyes, you can regrow organs.
If your hand is cut off, you can regrow a hand?
If your hand is cut off, you know, it's replacement body parts, it's replacement organs, it's longevity, it's wound healing, it's all those kinds of things. And it's coming very, very quickly, of course.
And so this is something that maybe you or I or people our children's age could benefit from?
You know, it's interesting. I had a torn rotator cuff. And they took plasma out of my body, spun it in a centrifuge, you know, enriched it with stem cells and shot it back into my shoulder, and it took what is a 2-year healing process down to a couple of months for me. So they're already doing this kind of stuff. It's already kind of available.
It's so interesting to me that, I mean, permeating all of these questions, and I think I and all of our listeners are probably interested in and excited by the potential of some of these technologies, particularly the medical ones. I don't care as much. I mean, you've got a chapter about flying motorcycles and things, which, I mean, whatever.
Well, you're laughing, though, but you actually do care a lot about that stuff. You may not care about flying motorcycles, but if you look at flying motorcycles and, say, Elon Musk's Hyperloop, right, which is his kind of high-speed train, so it links Los Angeles and Las Vegas by a 20-minute commute. The reason you care about these things is they're sort of gee whiz technologies, but they're going to radically reshape society. If you could suddenly say you weren't married and you're single and you live in Los Angeles, your dating pool historically has been limited by your geography. Suddenly, with flying cars, with transportations like the Hyperloop, the dating pool becomes many cities wide, right? It matters in terms of employment and where you live and where you can work. Those kinds of things are going to radically change your life. So you may not, you know, it may be a gee whiz, wow, we've invented the world's first flying motorcycle, but where we're going downstream from that is a radical kind of reshaping of the transportation industry, which could reshape the geography of every country in the world.
At the same time, permeating all of this is a fear of mortality, a non-acceptance of limitation, perhaps a fear of nature, certain era of our own nature. And I find myself, as I'm reading this, thinking about the differences between knowledge and wisdom. I mean, yeah, you can make amazing devices and you can extend your life and you can upload your mind, and but what about the wisdom of accepting the life cycle, accepting ourselves, accepting impermanence and suffering and death, which are parts of life, and the people, I mean, all the spiritual traditions that actually internalize that with wisdom. I mean, those are the happiest people ever, you know, Buddhist monks who accept impermanence rather than fighting it.
Personally, I agree with you. The life extension, I know a lot of people in the community, I know a lot of scientists working on it, and they're all very excited about it. Personally, I'm really curious to see what happens next. That's my personal stance. I think 80 years is a fine amount of time, and I'm really curious to see what happens next. These people feel radically differently about it, but I come down more on your side on this one.
Yeah, I mean, it does bring up a lot of questions about happiness. I mean, would I be happier if I could get on a flying motorcycle to meet somebody for dinner in Chicago? Or would I be happier going to the dog park and contemplating the clouds and going home? You know what I mean?
You know, it's interesting. I sort of talk about this in the introduction of the book from a different angle, which is there's been a lot of discussion over the years about why can't we stop technology, right? You can never, it never seems like we can ever put the genie back in the bottle, and what is that? And people have had all kinds of arguments. Kevin Kelly, kind of the former editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, kind of famously argued in What Technology Wants that technology is actually another form of life, right? And that explains why it's unstoppable. And he may be right, but I think there's a really simple kind of emotional answer here, which is technology is the promise of an easier tomorrow, right? It's saying, well, this thing I do today is really hard. This thing is going to make my life easier tomorrow. I love it for that. And it's something at a really deep emotional level. It's simply the promise of hope. And that's what, you know, the answer to your question is we can't stop technology because we can't stop hope. We keep thinking it's going to get easier here. And it doesn't, you know, the funny lesson about technology, of course, is while we can do all kinds of amazing stuff, it doesn't change the fact that it never really gets easier here, right? It's just hard here. Life is tricky sport.
Life is hard. Life is suffering. You make one thing easier, you make something else harder. I mean, there are some balances, and again, spiritual traditions acknowledge those balances. Everything has a dark side.
I think that's very, very true. And we're, I'm thinking of Nick Carr's The Shallows, and you know how the internet is making us, you know, people want to argue is making us stupid. It's definitely, you know, fundamentally changing our ability to pay attention, right, in shorter and shorter slices. So it is changing us, and there's, you know, to every upside there is a dark side. There's no way around it.
The scariest chapter for me was the one on synthetic biology, as it probably is for many of the people who read the book. And in the preface of that chapter, you quote author Howard Bloom as saying, "It's time to abandon the Greek idea that hubris is bad and face a simple fact. Hubris is what the cosmos seems to want from us. We humans are pushing beyond the boundaries of what this cosmos has ever achieved. In our acts of invention, we are not defacing nature, we are upgrading her. It's about humans who have the audacity to join in nature's creative process and in her quest for more than mere self-improvement, in her quest for self-reinvention." I mean, this is what you're talking about. And then you go on to write a chapter on how we are close to engineering DNA in a way that could provide both individualized medical cures, like you go to my DNA and cure my whatever disease I have, but also individualized bioattacks to the extent where you could somehow get the DNA of whoever you think is your enemy and create something that kills them and nobody else.
And that technology is actually here today, right? Like, we can essentially do that already. And, you know, the thing about synthetic biology, right? Synthetic biology basically says, hey, wait a minute, DNA is essentially computer code. And we can program DNA like we can program computer code, right? And it is the equipment to do this, by the way, is getting cheaper and cheaper, right? You can, you know, what used to be $1 million lab 5-10 years ago, you can get for $10,000 used on eBay.
Right.
And, we're seeing this stuff kind of, as you pointed out, being used phenomenally to create kind of new fuels, new foods, new medicines. There's really, really neat stuff there. The downside is it also means personalized bioweapons, right? And the scenario we talk about there is getting a strand of the president's DNA, which is really easy to do. DNA is a very long-lived molecule, and you shed millions of cells every day, right? Every time you shake hands with somebody or touch a cup or touch a pen. And by the way, the White House is already playing defense. Their Secret Service is charged with collecting the items that Obama touches for this very reason. Hillary Clinton, you know, in one of the WikiLeaks cables we saw a couple years ago, she alerted foreign kind of dignitaries that they should start surreptitiously collecting the DNA of, you know, any kind of foreign officials they run into. So we're already starting to muck with this, right? It's, you know, the creation of a personalized bioweapon where you target one person's DNA and you can aerosolize it. So you can spray something that smells like perfume in their face. Nobody else gets sick. They get a cold, and then maybe 6 months down the line, that turned into a neurodegenerative illness, and suddenly, you know, they're dead and nobody's the wiser.
And nobody can trace it.
And for sure, I mean, you know, the FBI has been, they've radically kind of changed their approach. Like, they have flat out said, look, we cannot police this technology. The only way we can do it is enlist the synthetic biology community and help, you know, get them involved in the policing. So it's going to radically kind of change how we can police the world.
Hope that they're on our side.
And the one thing you do have to, there's a counter to this, right, that can make this a little less scary, which is, you know, we are in the middle of a sensor revolution. Sensors are accelerating exponentially, right? So theoretically, as the bad guys, you know, get better and better, we're going to get better and better as well. That's the hope. One thing or another, synthetic biology puts enormous, enormous, enormous power into the hands of everyday citizens.
It's just about time to go, but I have to just say, when I think about science fiction and what I'd like to see come true, I mean, yeah, you know, it'd be nice not to get arthritis and degenerate and die in a horrible way or whatever, but mainly I'd like to see how we could learn to live with each other without fighting wars or the kind of brutality toward each other that is part of the human experience and that we seem to be so viciously good at. Is anybody working on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually wrote a piece for the New York Observer last week. This is just one aspect of it. But so everybody kind of, one of the things they've discovered about racism, for example, is that because evolution sort of wired us to think of us versus them, in-group versus out-group all along, we have a lot of inherent racisms, right? Like, they found that even the most, you know, anti-racist person, if you actually kind of look at brain responses, they will, you know, they will have outsized reactions to people of different colors neurologically, even if they're not physically acting on them. We've discovered how to overwrite those reactions. as of last week. So we're starting to play with stuff that is actually really getting at these questions. Once again, by the way, I think there could be massively unintended consequences here. I think, you know, when you, it sounds really nice that we're going to stamp out hate and racism with technology, but I got to tell you, I think those things are deep and human, and just like everything else that we're trying to stamp out, we're going to get something else in its place.
Stephen Kotler is a journalist and author. His new book is Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.